Yes, I know. Wednesday, half of another week, nearly the end of February, and here we are with me, Barry, on another book and a chat. Well, I was just talking to my guest. I'm in Connecticut, and we might just miss the bad weather. We've got a little bit sprinkling of snow tonight, but we might just miss the bad weather. And my guest was talking about sitting by the pool and stuff, in the 80s, Nice, isn't it, eh? Anyway, one of the things since I've retired is, I've always been one of these people that's always, never stops doing stuff. Always, I can't stand sitting around not doing anything and everything. And since I've retired, I actually do even more than ever, with the shows and the buying and selling and everything like that, and singing and what have you. Well, my guest, he wears me out just seeing what he does. I tell you, what can we tell about him? My guest today, he's a retired US Army officer. He's actually a retired major, but we don't teacher, public speaker, musician, martial artist. He's been teaching and doing martial art for over 50 years. Yeah, I know. Making you feel tired already? Okay. Former instructor at West Point and former editor of National Magazine. He's written non-fiction, he's written a play, he's written fiction. You name it, he's done it. He's got the t-shirts. And he's got a new book, in fact, a new series coming out. And I better introduce him, haven't I? Because on the show today, I have the one and only James D. Brewer, or as he'd allow me to call him, Jim. Hi, Jim, how are you doing?
I'm well tonight, sir. It's good to hear from you.
It's a pleasure to hear from you. And as I was saying in that introduction, you sort of look through what you've done and what you do and everything like that. I guess you're a bit like me. You don't get much free time, do you?
Well, I'm like you, I think, Barry. I feed on activity.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I always have. And this sounds like, I mean, I've always been, if I haven't been doing sport, I've been doing singing. If I've been singing, I've been doing this, that, and the other, And it's the same with you. And yet you're still finding time to write. I mean, you've written so many things, right back, articles for national magazines for 45 years about history, sports, human interest, self-defense, as we know, crime prevention, business. You've done five novels in one series. You've done non-fiction. You've done a two-act play. Has this writing thing been there since the start, or is it something you've sort of picked up as you got, that sort of perked your interest as you got on, you went on?
Well, I still teach for Polk State College here in Central Florida. And I teach as an adjunct for a couple of days a week, and I teach English composition and rhetoric. And as I tell my students, I look at them and I say, when I sat where you sat back in 1960, whatever, when I sat where you did, I had no idea I would ever be a writer.
Right.
And when I sat in my college freshman class and Mrs. Blythe, the Thunder Lizard English teacher, was bleeding red marks all over my paper, I had no idea I would ever do this. So this came to me after I graduated from college and had begun my adult life.
Okay, it's a bit like me. I mean, my English, I mean, well, I still can't spell. I mean, but it's just one of those things, but thank goodness for spell check now. That's all I'd say. But while I might have created the stuff, writing it down in a book and, and stories like that, I never, like you, I never thought I'd ever get to it. And it's amazing how it comes to you. But we were talking yesterday about this creative gene that people have. And in your case, it can show in sort of music, in painting, in sculpture, in all sort in writing sort of thing. It's not just writing in your case. You were playing, was it the High Road Ramblers you playing with?
Yes, my wife and I play. She plays the upright bass, the 4/4 bass, and I play guitar and banjo and mandolin and a couple of other instruments. And we do a nice mixture of the folk music from the 60s and the classic country and some bluegrass and some rockabilly. Just have a grand time doing that.
Well, see, again, a bit like me, these days with the shows and everything, I don't write the books much, but what I do is write parodies. And we go out singing, I belong to the local choral society, and we go out and do karaoke, and have a good laugh sort of thing. But it's creative again, isn't it? It's all this sort of, with the writing and, say, with the music and everything like that, you've got. And it's just something that people have, I think.
Well, I think you're kind of driven to do it in some cases. I know after I did the first five novels in the Macy Baldridge, Luke Williamson mystery series, And after I had done the three nonfiction books, I stepped away from the writing and focused on the music for almost 15 years.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And I wrote some songs that we would sing and perform with our group over the years. So the outlet was still there. I just redirected it.
Exactly.
I decided to. I was still doing magazine article length work, writing for various magazines and things. But then I decided to return to fiction writing. I wanted to do a new fiction series, and I'm well into that now. I'm into the third book in this series, and I'm already thinking about what I'm going to do next. My wife said, "Don't you want to take a little break?" And I said, No, I've got three ideas. I've got to figure out what series I'm going to do next. And
As you said, your first series, very well acclaimed, critically acclaimed, set of five novels, Macy Baldridge and Luke Williamson Mysteries. So I guess you like the old mysteries because your new series is a bit like that as well.
Indeed. Well, I grew up in a family that has its several generations back on the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. And I would hear stories told by my mother relayed from her father and grandfather on down the road. And that was what inspired me to set my series in the Mississippi River and Ohio Rivers, because everybody writes Westerns. You know, everything's a gunfight in Abilene.
Yep.
And I wanted, as Edgar Allan Poe said in his 1840 theory of composition, said you could either do the same thing everybody's doing in a new and different way, or you can do something new and different in the same old way, but you can't do the same old thing in the same old way.
Right. Your first, just ask you something here. Your first series, that was a set of five. Was that like a trilogy that became longer, or is it you just wanted to have a rest after five?
Well, the answer is the second part. After five, I was done with that. I had a nonfiction story, the Thomas Worthing story, that I was burning a hole in me. I'd been wanting to write that for a number of years, and I just put the brakes on that and went in a different direction.
And I know you said about you know the sort of the period it's in, but you are a bit of a Civil War buff, aren't you?
Yes, I grew up in West Tennessee, and from a very young age, I have been interested in that period. When I was teaching at West Point, I designed a special course where I took some cadets down to several battlefields and dressed them up in the uniforms of the period and rode with cavalry reenacting units. So, and that goes to the whole idea of research and historical fiction, Barry. I'm a firm believer in good, solid research and reflecting the time as accurately as possible.
And I think that's a big thing, you know, the accuracy of novels, because some of them you sort of... They're just a little bit beyond belief because the person hasn't done their homeworks per se, and you read it and think, yeah, that's wrong. Yeah, that doesn't happen. That's totally wrong.
Well, if I tell you what a yellow boy 45 long coat rifle sounds like when it's fired down at Kentucky Bend on the Mississippi River, mm-hmm. I've been down there and shot one.
Wow.
Okay, so I go to the ground, I walk the ground, I talk to local historians, I meet people that live in the area, I take a lot of photos, I use that to help design the story. But, you know, for all the research, and that's hugely important, and I love it, for all the research, I often tell young writers, the main thing you got to do is tell a good story, Barry. Mm.
Oh, yeah.
You can have perfect research, you can know all the facts, but if you can't tell a good story, you don't have a novel.
Yeah, I always class myself as a storyteller, not a writer. You know, I mean, you know, my bucket list this year, right, is to do a stand-up comedy routine. Right, that's on my bucket this year. But because when I tell a joke, it's a story, if you know what I mean. You know, it's
of course.
And it's like writing a book. You know, I had a person a couple of weeks ago and. They'd written a book and it was about abuse. Now, you know, on the show, you have to sort of go into the book and obviously you talk about that. But what they've done is they've taken their own experience and put it in a novel. Now, my view is that if somebody does that and they're reading a novel and they've been through something similar, they are putting themselves into that character. They are related. Oh, yeah. They're relating that rather than, you know, one of these seven do's and don'ts sort of thing, you know, which is just almost like a load of lists. If you've got somebody and they're reading it and they can put themselves into it, or they can relate to it, or they get taken along with it, you know, that's all an author can ask for, I think.
Well, that goes to the word of immediacy.
Yeah.
That gives immediacy in the story. You don't want to read a Walmart shopping list.
Exactly.
You want a story. And some people will come up to me and say, you know, I've got all this information about this particular time period, like 1938 in Denver, Colorado. So that's great that you know about Denver, Colorado in 1938. But what's the story?
Yeah.
Who are the characters? What do they want? Those are the kind of questions. When I do a writing seminar or work with a writing group, we talk about understanding what the character wants.
It's like the difference between a history book and a storybook.
Exactly.
Before we talk about your new series, I just want to ask about your martial arts stuff, because over 50 years now, something like that, is it?
Yes. I began training in 1969 in the cold concrete basement at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee. I trained in a system called Hapkido, and I trained for a couple of years, and then I trained in the Japanese style for a while, and then I got married, and we moved up into Kentucky, and I began to train in the Korean style, and I did that for a while, and then, of course, in the Army, I trained with the Army in combatives, and I've just continued to train in different systems and styles for 50 years. I teach sometimes in the school locally here. I'm not the full-time instructor there, but I just love to interact. I call it being in the community of like minds, and it's kind of like what you do.
Yeah.
You talk to writers about writing and the things that go with that, so you're in a community of like minds, and so I like to be in the dojo or the training hall among a community of like minds, and it's very fulfilling for me.
Okay. I call him my brother, but he's a close friend of mine, comes from Liverpool. And we always say, you know, he's from the north, I'm from the south of England, sort of thing. He still teaches. What is he? He must be like 76, 77 now. He still teaches, well, mainly judo, but he still teaches that. And like you, it's what he learned in like special forces in England, sort of thing. So it's carried on from there. We said about your love of the, you know, with obviously Florida and the sort of steamboats and that sort of area, and that is what your new series, a new set of books is sort of, what was it, 1885, something like that?
Yes.
It's the Florida, I'm going to try and say this, Chautauqua Murders.
Nice try, Barry.
I'm
afraid I'm going to have to mark your paper adversely here.
I'm sorry about that.
Okay, the term is Chautauqua.
Chautauqua. Do you know, I looked at that last bit and I said, that sounds, I know that from somewhere. Chautauqua. Oh, great.
Chautauqua. Are you familiar with the Chautauqua movement in this country?
It rings a vague bell. And I can't think what it is, but it's that's why I recognize the word, because I've come across it somewhere.
Well, in the 1800s, after the Civil War, people would initially start gathering, and it was like a prayer meeting or a Bible study or something. And they would find a place out in the country or somewhere, and they'd bring their tents and put them up, and they'd all preach and teach and sing. Then it expanded beyond religion to things like homemaking and baking and sewing and crafts. And then it became guest speakers coming in and talking about various things. Then it became talented musicians coming in and singing and playing. And it was a movement that grew through the country in the late 1800s. But it was normally in New York State and in the north, up in the northeast area. And it began to spread across the country. But Florida's first Chautauqua was held in 1885 in Dufuniac Springs, Florida, which is in the Florida Panhandle. Mm-hmm. And my story, the first book, is called Blood on the Cross Ties, the Florida Chautauqua Murders. And so this has to do with murder that takes place during Florida's first Chautauqua that's held. And all these people are coming down to Florida to participate in this Chautauqua. And you could come for a day, or you could come for a week, or you could buy a ticket to stay for 2 weeks. It reminds you a lot of going to a convention today.
Right. Was it? I'm thinking of Indian tribes. Is it sort of linked to that, or is it just a totally different thing?
It is a Native American word, so yeah. they've taken that from the Native American language.
Right.
But it is a gathering like that, and it's the entire series. The first book is built around the Chautauqua movement there, and what happens in the Panhandle.
Right.
But as I don't want to get ahead of your questions here, but as I conceptualized this series about 3 years ago now, I decided to start writing this. As I conceptualized this, I said, well, how am I going to build this? I live in Florida now, and unlike being set along the Mississippi River, now I live in Florida. I wanted to set it in Florida. I wanted a book in this area so I could do a lot of good research and learn a lot about mm-hmm. it. And I kept thinking, now, how do I divide? If I want to do more than one in this series, how do I divide this up?
Right.
And it came to me in a very interesting way. I was trying to figure out, what am I going to do? Maybe three in this series? And then I realized there were three great railroad barons
okay.
that were instrumental in settling Florida and opening it up to tourism in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
One was William Chipley, and he was part of the L&N Railroad and built the railroad from Pensacola to Tallahassee throughout the Panhandle.
Right.
And then everybody probably heard of Henry Flagler that mm-hmm. built Flagler University, named after him, and he built the railroad down the east coast of Florida all the way to Key West.
Right.
And the third great railroad baron was Henry Plant. And Henry Plant built a huge railroad system through Georgia and central and western Florida over on the Gulf Coast. So I thought, well, I know what. My railroad detective is going to work for the three great railroad barons of Florida.
There you go. Right. What a great idea.
That's the germination of the series.
That's a great idea. I mean, and it allows you to bring in all sorts of stuff, and especially with your first one here with the murder and everything like that. It's great, and it brings in your the stuff you like, the stuff you really enjoy, investigating and studying etc. So if it's this Blood on the Cross Ties, is this the first of three then? Yeah,
it is the first of the three. As I said, it's set in the Panhandle. The second one is set in St. Augustine and Palatka over on the East Coast, and it's set like 6 months later after the first one. And the third one is set in 1887, the next year, and it's set over in Tampa and down into Central Florida around Arcadia and Port
right.
Charlotte.
Now,
the characters are continuing. It's continuing characters. The main character in this story, and these characters are different from the characters that were in my first series.
Yep.
They're quite different in their nature. The main character is Jimmy Lee Parker, and he is half Choctaw Indian
right.
and half white. His father was a full-blooded Choctaw, and his mother was a French Arcadian woman whose father had found abandoned and frozen and half cold and taken in and became his wife. And so he's the product of that union. And he's a man who tries to walk the line between two cultures.
Mm.
And he's never really quite at home in either one. But he has become this railroad detective because of his attention to detail and his experience and his cleverness. He's the main character in this story. And the other two characters in this story, and they continue through the series, he's got a good close friend by the name of Angus Chubb Moody. Chubb, C-H-U-B, is a nickname.
Mm-hmm.
And Angus Moody is a friend of his, but Angus describes himself as a general flunky.
Right.
He's gone from job to job his whole life.
Right.
He's overweight, and he's self-conscious about that. But he really counts on the time he spends when he gets a call from Choctaw Parker to come and help him on a case. That's the center of his life. That's what he lives for. So he's just very loyal to Choctaw Parker. And the third character in this story is a widowed gambler
Okay.
whose husband was killed in the Civil War, and she has a son who's 18 or 19, and she goes on the road 9 months out of the year and runs faro games and is a gambler. And she is quite resourceful.
Right, I
And
bet, I bet.
she has to be, you know. And
Exactly.
I tell her story because people don't realize what women who lost their husbands in the Civil War had to go through just to survive, Barry.
Yeah. Oh,
I
yeah.
mean, you only had about four choices. You could either remarry someone with money, or who you may or may not love, or you could become a prostitute, which some did, or you could take in sewing and wash.
Right.
But after that, there weren't a lot of choices for a woman in those days.
Right. Yeah, I
So
mean they
this.
didn't have didn't I mean when was it? I mean they didn't even have a bank account till 40s, 50s or something,
Exactly.
yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So we tell her story of what it's like for her, and she gets hooked up with Jimmy Lee, and not hooked up in the sexual sense
Right.
of today's usage. But she ends up linking up with Jimmy Lee and Angus Chubb Moody, and they work to solve all manner of murder most foul along the Pensacola and Atlantic Railroad in 1885.
It's great that you bring in the railroad part because it's an educational as well. I mean, just you mentioning the different railroads, I'd heard of a couple before, but I never knew of the sort of the third one you said about. I never heard of that one. And I think, oh, crikey, yeah, well, of course you can imagine there must have been. I knew there was lots of different railroads, like any country sort of thing. But the fact that you've been able to bring that with these people and pretty diverse people, into this murder mystery is great that you got the sort of after the war, before the turn of the century sort of thing. It's a big time, a lot of things going on.
Oh, what a rich time. That's why I wanted to write the first series, because it's set basically in the 1870s. But there was so much happening by the 1880s. You've got the invention of the electric light.
Yeah.
You've got Thomas Edison makes an appearance in the second book.
Okay.
You've got the electric light. You've got the telephone becomes instrumental in one of the stories because it's just becoming available. And when you write a historical mystery like this, you don't have the privilege of showing a little box on the page where somebody got a text message.
Right.
Things are a lot tougher to communicate in those days.
That's
So,
right. Yeah. I mean, you've got the telegraph a bit, but not much else. And then it's suddenly the whole thing just ex communication and travel just explodes.
absolutely. And most people don't even realize that we have time zones in the United States today
Right.
because of because of the railroad.
Right.
In order for railroads to have schedules, you couldn't have every county have a different time. So that's how we came up with time zones that we use Eastern and all the way across to the Western time zones, because the railroad had to be able to put a schedule together.
Yeah.
So the railroad was hugely important in those days.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, people made and lost fortunes on it, didn't they? Just with land and everything else like that. It was a huge opening up of boundaries for normal everyday people to travel.
Oh, yes. And in book three of the series that I'm working on now, I mean, you've got Henry Plants. He's got a railroad empire and a steamship line running to Cuba, and he's trying to buy another railroad, but not everybody's happy about that.
Right,
Not everybody is happy about that.
yeah.
And
People,
that, and that,
go ahead,
go
go
ahead,
ahead.
sir.
Now, I was going to say, people tend to forget that Cuba in those days was quite an important, place that everybody, Americans went through and everything like that. I was just in the books I was saying I was reading. Yeah, they sort of used it as a harbor. And the American Navy was sort of just developing in those days as well, sort of thing. And it's quite an important place. You forget what it used to be, sort of thing.
Yes, oh yes. Because, in every situation where people are trying to expand and open up Florida tourism and trade, there are always people who have something to lose when that happens. For example, once the railroads began to flex their muscles, the steamboat industry began to suffer. So the very industry that was the center of my first series, in this series, they're now struggling to stay alive, and they've got something to lose by the success of the railroad.
Indeed, so you can just imagine it. It's been fascinating chatting to you, Jim. Really has, and I'm sure these books. The more I hear about them from you, this new series, and the more I think it's going to. It's piqued my interest. I know. I'm sure a lot of other people as well. But what I'm going to do now, Jim, is actually hand the show over to you and have you tell everybody where they can go and find out more about you and about your books and everything else. So over to you.
Well, I really appreciate the chance to talk with you tonight, Barry, and to your audience. I believe you just need to tell a good story, and that's what I try to do. If you want to know more about my works, you can go to my website, which is www.jamesdbrewerwriter.com. It's all just one series there, jamesdbrewerwriter.com. And all my stuff is listed on there that I've done over the years. And I have an emerging series I'm working on there. I'm putting a few chapters on each week, which is more of a memoir, a nonfiction memoir. The books themselves will be available from Touchpoint Press. So touchpointpress.com. It's not released just yet. It was supposed to be released on the 7th, but they're running a few weeks behind. So I think it's probably going to be the middle of March before it's actually going to be released. But you can go to touchpointpress.com, and of course it will be available on Amazon upon release as well.
Okay. Well, Jim, thank you so much for being a guest on this show. Good luck with the book when it comes out.
Listen, if you want to go do that comedy routine, you and I could do a heck Abbott and Costello.
Who's on first?
Yes. I don't know. What's on second?
I don't know. Yes, it's funny. I was talking to, quickly before we took right out of time, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they said, watching these sort of reaction things on YouTube, you know, and saying about Abbott and Costello, oh, I never heard of him. I remember going to Saturday Morning Pictures. They were originally before Scooby-Doo. Used to have Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein and Abbott and Costello meet the mummy and stuff like that. So even in England we had it.
Well, between your British accent and my Southern accent, yeah. I think together, we'd pack a heck of a show.
We would. No problem at all. Anyway, Jim, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Barry. Good luck to you and your future broadcast.
Thank you. Well, how about that? My guest today, James D. Brewer, or Major. Retired James D. Brewer, and as he said, you can find more about him on James D. Brewer Writer, all one word, jamesdbrewerwriter.com. Lots to find out about, lots to see about his books and everything like that. Really, really interesting person, as we just heard. Anyway, that's it for today. I'll be back on Sunday with my music shows. First of all, between 5 and 6 p.m., we have those were the days, music from the 20th century, and the theme, the last one in February, because February being my birthday, it's Barry's Picks. So it's the last one of Barry's Picks. We've got themes for already sorted out for March, but that's between 5 and 6 p.m. Eastern. And then between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern, we have the Swinging 60s. Yes, music from the 60s. Not just the British invasion, from around the world. And then, of course, next Tuesday and Wednesday, I'm back with chat shows. Anyway.